will you do without freedom? Will you fight?
Welcome to Leverage Addicts, the podcast for investors looking to maximize returns through leverage. Join host, seasoned mortgage professional and real estate enthusiast, Blandon Lerm, as we explore property investing strategies and learn how to navigate the market to build new wealth.
Welcome back, Leverage Addicts. Today, we're tackling a common hurdle that new and veteran investors face. That is running out of borrowing capacity. Now, a lot of people, when they get into the situation, the only question they would ask is, can I borrow more from the bank? And the challenge that they run into is like, well, because I can't borrow more, so I'm not going to keep growing my portfolio. I'm just going to stay where I am. And they have this belief that potentially, you know, I just have to hold and then just be in the situation that I am in, right? In other words, they essentially let the bank dictate their progress in properties. Now, if the goal to grow is important enough, there is always a solution, and it's whether or not you want to put in the effort to actually execute on some of these ideas, because at the end of the day, some of these challenges that we run into, someone else have solved them. So what if there is a whole world of possibility beyond just borrowing more money from the bank? There's other ways that we've talked about in the channel, you know, such as replacing some of the opportunities that you have with something that has higher return that's going to allow you to keep growing. But today I want to focus on five financing strategies that you should know. And these strategies are not just made up, right? These are proven. These are ones that I've helped my clients with and also successfully implemented some of them myself. So I'm going to share them with you. Hopefully that will give you some new perspectives on how you can move forward with your portfolio. Now, what we're going to do is we're going to start with the basics. We're going to start with the traditional methods of, you know, everyone knows these financing strategies. Then we move into some more advanced one. I'm going to show you some examples. And these are examples of how our clients or even myself have executed on them. And then that might give you some new ways to approach your own portfolio. So that might unlock some opportunities that you've never considered possible. Now, remember, the key, again, is not just asking the bank or asking how much you can borrow from a bank. It's understanding people who were in your situation, you know, how have they thought about financing more creatively and move forward from it. So if you're ready to expand your investment portfolio and discover new ways to do deals, then you've come to the right place. All right. So diving into the first one is cash, right? Okay. Simply put, you have cash, you buy the property. Now, ideal for high interest rate environment and, you know, the stock market is tanking. You don't know where else to park your money. Property prices have depleted. Perhaps you want to park some cash there. Now, the advantage is obviously no interest repayment when you're buying with cash. So you're purely buying the asset and then you're just getting the rent that you're getting on that property. It's a better negotiation position as well if you can buy with cash, right? Because you can just make that unconditional offer without due diligence. Or maybe you've done the due diligence beforehand and you can just go in unconditional straight away. So that's going to give you a smoother purchasing process. But the risk and limitation, obviously, you know, you could tie up a large amount of your capital in one investment. You potentially miss out on other opportunities that you could leverage on. So in my opinion, if you're just buying properties with cash, it's not the best asset to explore because other assets like share historically offer a higher return on your cash position. Let's say you've got $1 million, you buy shares, you buy properties, chances are you're gonna win in the long run with shares. That's because in property, you are not taking full advantage of the most important thing, which is leverage, which is the second strategy for financing, okay? Because this amplifies your return. So what is leverage? Again, if you're a new listener, if you're just getting to investments, then understand this. If you have a property, okay, you buy it for $500,000, you get 5% return, it's $25,000, okay? So you buy it with cash, you put in $500,000. Now, realistically, most properties you only have to put in right now 35%, at times if it's your first investment, maybe you can get away with 20% at second tier banks. So that means for the same $500,000 property, you're only putting in a small portion, $100,000. And therefore, that $25,000 of capital gains is on the $100,000 principal that you've put in. meaning you got 25% return opposed to just 5%. So that's why leverage is so powerful when it comes to properties. It increases your purchasing power, obviously, and it can give you higher return on your equity. Now, the advantage as well is because the government's changed some of the tax rules, the interest repayments or interest that you get charged on the property is tax deductible. So that means you can pay it with pre-tax money. It's a massive advantage for property investing. Some of the risk and limitations, obviously, you're exposed to more debt. And that, therefore, if there is a market downturn, that downturn is actually amplified, right? If you think about it like this, say, for example, bought a property for $1 million and you put in 10% deposit only and you borrow $900,000, the market goes down 10%, you've lost your whole deposit because now the property is worth $900,000. And if you sold it, it only covers the debt. So that's the downside with leverage. Now, if you are very good at buying properties, right, being able to leave margin of safety, this is something that we have talked about. You know, this is a theory that Warren Buffett talks about in his investing, is that when you buy, you always buy with a margin of safety. And meaning if the market turns, right, you already have an inbuilt margin in there. So maybe that property that's worth $1 million, you buy for $900,000, market goes down 10%, you've only lost nothing because you bought it for $900,000. Okay, so that's really, really important. And the other thing that's to perhaps explore with leverage is that you can use pure equity to buy properties. What is that? If you've got a property, I'll give you an example of my first investment property. I had a pre-approval, you know, with a small deposit, couldn't find anything. And then someone showed me, a broker actually showed me that I could use the equity on my mom and dad's property and they don't have to put in any more money. And as long as I pay for the mortgage, they don't feel any different, right? They couldn't borrow that money themselves because of maybe their borrowing capacity is not as good. But if I add myself in, and I can use that equity, I could buy a property with 100% finance. So I bought my first property for $670,000 because my mom and dad's property has got, you know, like a only less than 40% mortgage on it. So I was able to buy something and then I just pay for the mortgage. And when that property goes up in value, I can then break away from my parents because now there's some equity in my deal and I can break away. So if you try to apply it in your own situation, well, you don't have to invest with other people, right? You can just buy that first property. And then when the value goes up, it's a standalone investment. So that's the way you can think about leverage. Now, the third one is still obvious. And why would you use it is joint venture. Joint venture is good when perhaps you can utilize different expertise. You could maybe split the money and the time invested. So maybe someone has a bit more capital, someone has more time. A joint venture is great. And maybe you don't have enough of a deposit to do the deal. Then doing the joint venture allows you to get into those deals, the really good deal where you're like, you know what, I still need to do this deal and someone else could make some money off it as well. This could give you a, you know, a much larger portfolio. So advantage, we already talked about it. You've got shared risk, right? You can combine your skills and network. You have more capital to work with. But the downside is obviously now more people, more complexity, right? More people, more complexity and potential conflicts. So you have to divide the profit and you might have to be reliant on the partnership for decision-making. You know, getting an extra signature sometimes can be hard, right? Like decision to sell a property. I see this all the time in the business is like, you know, people get into business together, but one person wants to sell, the other doesn't. And that, you know, slows things down. How have I utilized it? Obviously, there's a lot of clients that use it as well. So maybe I'll give you an example. JP actually is in a YouTube channel. So I mentioned his name. JP, when he first started, he's got his own unit and then he was able to top up a little bit of equity, but not enough to buy a property outright. So him and his friends, like there are two other partners, they put up a deposit together so that they could buy this property where they could renovate it and then sell it. And then they went on to do 20 of those kind of deals, you know, while working full time. So you can watch that YouTube, yeah, on the channel. He shares, you know, what are the struggles with, you know, working and doing all of that at the same time. Myself, I've done a JV, you know, at the time, one of my good friends, Michael, he had this deal, like he wasn't 100% certain that he wants to do it by himself. It was in Hastings or around 570K, had 8.5% cash flow at the time. You know, interest rate was like closer to 5. So it was cash flow positive, but he hasn't invested, you know, in Hastings before. So he wanted to maybe mitigate the risk. And if he could see other people put the money in, he is more comfortable and that will make him happier. So then I put in 100,000 as well. He put in 100,000. We got a small mortgage of 400,000. And that property, you know, we've held for a while now for 5 years. And the other day, like I don't even look at the bank account, but over the years, you know, that the cash balance just builds up And, you know, we had like something like 55, 60,000 sitting in there, and we decided to take a dividend out of it instead of paying it down because it was still cash flow positive on the higher interest rate. So it was a really good deal. So if you think about it like this, we put in 100,000 each after 5 years, you know, we've got 50,000 sitting in there. So you could say average, it's giving you an 8% cash on cash return, right? Like 8 to 10%. Also, you've got the upside of the capital gains. So that's a really good way to do joint ventures. Now, the fourth strategy is a bit more advanced, right? This is going to require like legal structures. It's going to require accounting advice there. So general partnership and limited partnership. What are those terms? Sounds big, right? But this is how, you know, companies like William Corporation scale, right? If you don't run a borrowing capacity, you're going to run out of capital. If you don't run out of capital, you're going to run out of borrowing capacity. So if you look at William Corporation, the way they have grew their company is using the same GP-LP model. It might be called something different, but essentially it's the same. So how does it work? Like if you think about it, William Corporation, they were really good at buying the property, developing them and selling them. But at some point, they're going to run out of capital because if every single deal they have tie up $1 million, they are going to run out of capital before they run out of properties to buy. So what do? They started this fund, and this fund, they give their investors 10% return. And so this is what we call the limited partner. They have limited decision making in the deal. They put up the capital to settle the property, and then William Corporation, because they've pre-sold the property, they could get the finance from the bank without having to put in more of their own capital. Well, in their proposal, they say they always put in some capital, which is a good thing because, you know, the investors would trust them more. But this is a very common way of developers scaling their business. How do you do it on a mom and dad level? Because, you know, you don't have to do large developments to structure a deal like that. So the general partners are the decision makers, and they usually are the ones that bear all the debt obligation. Okay, so this is great if you're really good at finding deals and then you're running out of capital, you can bring in friends and family. Okay, so how could you structure a deal like this? I'll give you an example. Sally is also on a YouTube channel. You can watch her story about trading. So Sally's done hundreds of trades, right? And she coaches other people on how to do trades. So she's in a very strong negotiation position when it comes to like, hey, look, I've got a really good deal. I'm going to do all the work. And so she doesn't have to give the same profit to the people who put up the money. So she'll have limited partners that she'll promise like a fixed return and then a bit of the upside as well. And then she would get majority of the upside because she found a deal, she manages the deal. And this is a really good way. So this way she puts up little to no capital for a good upside. And then the LP partners or the limited partners, they're getting a really good upside because they can't find those kind of deals themselves. And so they get a promise return, like a fixed return plus a share profit as well. So which is a really good way for a more established investor to grow. So how could you structure it this way with friends and family? If you've got a deal, you can actually set up what we call a partition agreement, you know, because at some point, like, why would you use a partition agreement? So maybe I went too fast there. If you structure a deal with friends and family, what you're going to find is that the bank starts getting iffy around like, hey, you've got multi-household, you're not going to be able to borrow as much. So this is going to be a challenge that you run into. How you could do this is set up a partition agreement. This is essentially just a like a agreement that is not on the title, but between you and another party, if you sold this property, this is the share that they would get. So then on the title, only you, the borrower, will show up on the title. But the background, you've got an agreement that says, hey, at some point in the future, this is how you would split the profit. This is how you would split the cash flow. And this is a great way for someone to keep growing their portfolio. So the very last one, this is harder to negotiate. So that's why I put it as the fifth strategy and harder to execute. And this is vendor finance. When would you use it? When the buyer lacks immediate funding or they don't want to use the traditional financing methods. Okay. Why would you use this? Well, if you don't have a deposit to start with, but you can negotiate good terms with the seller, you can enable the transaction. You can actually make it happen, make both sides happy, and you can put up very little capital to do a deal. So this is way more flexible than a bank loan, but you can still get a bank loan if the terms are right, if the agreements are good and the borrowing capacity is strong there. Okay, so obviously there are risks and limitations with this. Again, harder to negotiate. You are probably going to end up with higher interest rates than a normal loan because vendor would expect a higher return than the bank. So I'll give you an example. This is very common when you are starting out in properties and you're buying off mom and dad, and you're like, I don't have the deposit to buy off mom and dad. What would you do? So Jackson is a good friend and his family already doing development. So they want to kick off their son's development venture. So they had like a $1.3 million property. Jackson could only borrow $700K. So it's a shortfall of $800,000. So what we ended up doing was we got the $700,000 to settle the property. Then the $800,000 is vendor finance. So this is an agreement between Jackson and the parents to say, hey, $800,000 is what Jackson owed the parents. This is like on the side, you know, like you don't have to have a formal agreement if it's family, right? But to make it a bit more formal, you can have like a deed of debt acknowledgement. So this is something that potentially will affect the borrowing. So I need to tell you upfront as well. So if you set up something like that, it might affect the borrowing. But if you have informal agreement, maybe the parents just like, yep, you can pay us later when you do the development and finish it. So we settled a loan for $700,000 and Jackson could then go ahead and get the resource building consent. And then once he has those, then we are going to refinance to a construction bank and we're able to do the development, maybe get some pre-sales and then do the development, sell those property, give back the $800,000 in the future. So that's a really common way. The other one is a bit more complex called rent to buy. So rent to buy is when you basically not getting a loan to settle the property. All you're doing is in the beginning, you give higher than normal rent, but all of the extra that you're paying is going towards the principal to set up the deposit. This is really common back in the days when, you know, there's, I guess, legal structure was less complex. Nowadays is a bit more harder, but you can still execute it. So if you think about it like this, if you want to buy a property and you're like, I don't have a deposit, you can pay your landlord more money and a portion of that goes towards the deposit. And then, you know, maybe you are paying for cheaper rent in the interim as well. Why would the vendor want to do this? Why would the landlord want to do this? Well, for them, the advantage is that they're actually getting a higher cash flow position. They don't actually need lump sums of cash right now, but they have a higher cash flow. It's going to allow them to have, you know, more living expense that they can use right now, better borrowing capacity. So this is actually advantageous for the landlord as well. So now it's a win-win. You can pay lower than market rent, but more of the money goes towards the principal. And that way you can end up, you know, getting a house in the future. So of course, the downside for this is that, again, you're paying higher than normal rent, but you could own the house in the future. And you got to make sure that perhaps you go for balloon payment. You're not going for like paying a higher cash flow for the 30 years. So balloon payment means that maybe 3 years down the track, you can come up with the difference on the deposit and then finance the rest of it from the bank. And that way you could pay out the landlord sometime in the future, like 3 years down the track. So those are the five methods. Again, obviously, you can always do a deal with cash. Secondly, you can borrow money. Thirdly, you can do a joint venture, find other people to do a deal with. Maybe this is like a bit more equitable deal where you both put in similar amounts. And then the fourth one is now you're looking at general partnership and limited partnership. That means that you're in a more stronger negotiating power position where, you know, the limited partners just don't want to do anything. They just want to return. And then the fifth one is, you know, vendor finance. How do you negotiate a deal? This is very common in business as well. So you can get very creative once you start exploring those strategies. Now, you don't have to know all of this. You only need to know somebody that can advise you on them, right? And so that is the good thing, you know, if you get a mortgage advisor that do these kind of deals themselves, you know, just naming our senior advisors, like I know what's going on with the deals. They're all doing something exciting. Like Sam is doing relocatables with other joint venture partners. Z is doing his 6-lot developments in Point England. Simon's just finished his 2-lot in his backyard and is doing another 6-lot resource consent. You know, Ray's got regional properties. Yan's got regional properties, you know, and they all buy properties themselves. They're all investors. So, you know, if you need to do something that's a little bit more outside the box than just getting a pre-approval, you need some advice. Our senior advisor, they're all running deals and they do mortgages as their day job. So this is something I know will be advantageous for you, because if you are, you know, looking to expand and grow, then a good mortgage advisor on your team is going to be vital. So if you learned something today, all I ask for is one simple request. That is to share this episode with another person that's going to benefit from it. And until next time, we'll talk more properties. I'll see you guys again.